Thanks for turning there. You know, when I was in Bible college, the Bible college that I went to, we had a correspondence school. And, that kind of thing isn't very common anymore. Occasionally, sometimes some people have an online program or something like that, but not a whole lot of things like correspondence courses. But at the time, it was a really big deal. And I remember that as I was coming into this Bible college, they were talking about how many people were going to the Bible college through this correspondence program and that it was free. And you got to understand that the school was free. You just had to show up with enough money to live on and be able to be there 8 hours a day. And you couldn't work in the evenings because they had you doing things at night. So they basically, it was 8 hours all day, working every night for the church, and you got through your four-year degree in just 2 years. And it was kind of tough. So people would take this correspondence course because they couldn't come and relocate or whatever. And so, and there were a lot of the people that were taking the course were prisoners. Some were housewives. Some of them were college students that were just wanting to get some extra courses in. Other people were from other lands and they wanted to learn some more English, and they thought that was an easy way. They could get a Bible in their language and they would look at the text in the English, and then they could go back and forth and they would begin to learn to learn English that way. So we had a number of people taking these classes, and I just assumed that because it was the same courses that we were taking and that they would go through the entire Bible over the course of that curriculum, that the teachers themselves were grading the courses. Well, after I'd been there for a little while, we were about halfway through the program, and they decided they would do something really nice for the correspondence teachers. Apparently, they were all volunteers. Most of them, like little, old grandmas, and they were like spending their time that they had receiving those courses and grading them. And then they would, if there was a new course to be sent out, they would go to the print shop where the school had their print shop, and they would pick up the next set of courses, and they would mail those to people. And that's how they were doing this. They were just, these people were mailing these things out. A few of them were dads that maybe had been disabled or were out of work for a season, or maybe they worked nights, different things. But by far and away, the majority of teachers were retired women who were pouring their heart and soul into communicating with our correspondence students. And so they thought, well, let's do something really nice for them. The program had been going for about 25 years at the time, and the school was about 40 years old. And they said, I've got this great idea. Let's have a banquet for all of those teachers. And so they got the staff, they got the all the Bible college students together, because if the school was going to do anything, since everything was free, that meant we got to do all the labor. And so they said, hey, you're going to throw a banquet for these correspondence teachers. And we said, yeah, that's great. And so I had no idea what to expect. We put together this big banquet, and these ladies were coming, and they started recognizing them for all the students that they had been teaching and for the effect that they had had in reaching out to people all over the world. But the star of the night was a little lady in her 80s. Now, I want you to understand, we're talking, this was back in the 80s. And I don't know if you remember, but back in the 80s, I didn't meet a whole lot of older women in their 80s. It's certainly not vibrant and active. And so they began to tell the story of this one lady, and they invited her to come up after they told her story. And I remember her walking up. She was bent over. She was considerably crippled up. Her hands were gnarled up with arthritis. And as she came, they began to tell the story of how over the last 25 years that she on average had led 75 people to Christ every year. That she had taken her little bit of money that she had, and she kept going. Every time she would find a new magazine or a new advertisement in the back of something, she would take and she would write her little ad for her correspondence class, and she got her own P.O. drawer. It started out as a box. Eventually, she had to have a P.O. box drawer, and she would get all this mail from the post office every day. Eventually, she had to have help because she had so much mail coming in, and she had led over 2,000 people to Christ in that course of 25 years, and wrote, it was so beautiful, she would every time she got a new correspondent, she would get a whole notebook set aside just for them. And she would keep notes about every person. If they were in prison, when they went into prison, when they were getting out, how she could pray for them. She kept track of their family members. She drew family trees. It was quite elaborate. I got to see some of her notebooks. I was really impressed. And then she kept track of every letter. She kept a copy of every letter she wrote. And understand, it wasn't like just walking over to the printer in your house and making a copy. She had to get someone to make those copies for her. She had thousands of students all over the world. And she was making this tremendous impact. And I watched times where, with those crippled up hands, she wrote the most beautiful, loving letters to every single correspondent. And that many of them she continued to write years after they had finished the course. And their lives had been changed, all by this sweet little old lady who seemingly had nothing to give. More than 75 people every year came to Christ because of her. Over 2,000 people in 25 years in her retirement. You don't have to be powerful. You don't have to be savvy. You don't have to live in a big city or have a great education. You don't have to be wealthy or influential. To make a difference, you only have to be faithful with the gifts you have, and God will give the increase. God can use those of little power who are faithful to do mighty works for the kingdom of God. Take a look with me, if you will, Revelation chapter 3, beginning in verse 7. I'll be reading from the English Standard Version. Please read along in whatever translation you have. That one's my favorite one. And to the angel in the church of Philadelphia write, these are the words of the Holy One, the true One, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, who shuts and no one opens. I know your works. Behold, I have set before you an open door, which no one is able to shut. I know that you have but little power, and that you have kept my word and have not denied my name. Behold, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan, who say that they are Jews but are not, but lie. Behold, I will come and make them bow down before your feet, and they will learn that I have loved you, because you have kept my word about patient endurance. And I will keep you from the hour of trial that is coming on the whole world to try those who dwell on the earth. I'm coming soon. Hold fast what you have, so that no one may seize your crown. The one who conquers, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. Never shall he go out of it. And I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down from my God out of heaven, and my own new name. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. Now, the city of Philadelphia was really an amazing city in the first century. The patron of the city was a man by the name of Attalus II. He was an evangelist of Greek culture. Now, when I say evangelist, I don't mean evangelist in the sense of that he was bringing the good news of the gospel. I mean he was bringing the good news of Hellenistic culture, of Greek culture. That was his passion. That was what he was excited about. He had an ambition to reach the whole world with Greek culture. He thought the whole world would be better off if everybody was like the Greeks. And doing so, Attalus spent his vast resources enhancing the city, promoting its culture, advancing the cause of Hellenization, building libraries and public buildings and temples. He was known for his great generosity and how he would help people in the city who were in need. But what he was known for even more was the love of his brother, Eumenes. We're not told exactly what was the challenges that Eumenes faced, but somehow he was limited in his capacity. And yet Attalus loved him so dearly, and it was so well known in public, that when they went to name the city after him in his honor, instead of naming the city Attalus, they named it Philadelphia, the lover of a brother. That was his reputation. One who was generous to a fault, one who brought hope and to the community, and one who so loved his brother that everybody stopped and took notice. That was what that city was known for. Pretty good reputation, if you ask me. I don't know if anybody, when you think about Philadelphia in the United States, if that's what you think about. I don't think that that is necessarily the reputation of Philadelphia in the United States. But I can see why anybody would want to name their city Philadelphia. It's a great name. And certainly from the standpoint of a biblical standpoint, this church was a strong church, a good church. People would want to identify with that. Now, as Jesus is speaking to the church, he identifies himself in a way that is unique. He calls himself the Key of David. And the Key of David references Isaiah 22, verse 22, referring to Eliakim, who was the faithful steward of King Hezekiah. He was also called the Key of David. And the reason he was called the Key of David was that he was the one and only person who determined who got into the presence of the king. In other words, if you wanted to be in the presence of the lineage of King David, if you wanted to come to that king, you had to go through him. He determined who came in and who got shut out. And so the picture is very clear. If you want to come before the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, Jesus is the key. And so he says, I'm the one. I'm the Key of David. And the clear implication being that he who has the key, being Jesus, opens the doors and shuts them. The throne of God is opened only to those who come to Jesus. And it's why a number of churches will call themselves the Church of the Open Door. In fact, there's a whole denomination that calls itself the Church of the Open Door. Or sometimes there's Open Door Reformed Church, Open Door Baptist Church, Open Door Christian Church, Open Door this, Open Door that. Everybody wants to be the Open Door. Everybody wants to have access into the presence of God. But the difference is that the church in Philadelphia didn't call themselves that. That was what Jesus said about them. I think that's a pretty impressive statement for someone to make about a church. Wouldn't you want your church to be known as the place that has an open door into the very presence of God? That Jesus would say about your church, this is the church of the open door. Then as we look into this letter, it stands out that it is only one of two churches in the seven churches of Asia that doesn't receive any correction. Instead, this church is known and is commended as the one that has already proven its worth. It's shown itself faithful in time of trial, and that's the reason that God has opened the door of his presence and is making them to be known as pillars of God's temple. Man, when you think of a pillar of a temple, and this is particularly important because there in Philadelphia, where they would have had a lot of Greek architecture, the difference between your private house and the big public place of worship or a library or anything like that would have had giant columns out front to symbolize the important architecture, to make known that this is a place of public gathering. And so that whole image of them becoming a pillar in the temple of God, a foundation to the society that they were in. And so all over Philadelphia, it would have been understood what being a pillar was. We use the term sometimes rather loosely in churches, talking about somebody being a pillar of the church or a pillar of the community and things like that. But God said about them that his desire was that they would be a pillar not of the city of Philadelphia, but of the very temple of God. Wow. And then lastly, they've been promised that God will keep them from a persecution that's soon coming at that point into the whole known world, to all of the Roman world that all the other churches were getting ready to face. And yet he says to them, but I will keep you from it and I will write on you a new name. Wow. Philadelphia. Apparently it's a very small church, very little power, and yet it is greatly loved. It's faithful in the way that God has always meant for his people to be faithful, because that was what sustained them. That was their expectation, that God was for them. And so they poured heart and soul into honoring God and to being the people of God. They reached out to their community and even were suffering great persecution, apparently at the hands of other Jews in the community. You understand that that at this time, that the majority of Christians were Jews. And even in these seven cities in Asia, that the majority of Christians in those community are also Jews, that there were very large Jewish communities, and that Christianity as a whole was not seen as something that was separate or independent of race or anything like that, but it was seen as that Jewish thing. And so oftentimes they were looked at as just one of the many synagogues in the area and treated as such. And if you think about Judaism in the first century, the reality is much like it has been in the history, even in modern history, where the Jews have experienced times of where they were respected and loved and cared for, and other times where nations have oppressed them and treated them very poorly because of their unique identity. And certainly during this time, the Jews were still wrestling with that sense of place and identity, especially in the city of Philadelphia. It was one of the largest Jewish communities in the world at that time. In fact, Jerusalem was, you know, waning, and the nation by this time, I can't remember the name of the Caesar that did it. All of a sudden, I'm drawing a blank. But he had decided that they were going to be called Palestine, that it was no longer to be known as Jerusalem or Israel because of their anger over what had happened in the battle between Israel and Rome. And they had decimated Jerusalem, torn down the city walls, torn up the temple. By this time, The temple has already been destroyed. And so this is the largest community of Jews any place in the world at the time. And now there's this battle between the Jews and the Christians, because by far and away the majority of Christians are Jewish. And even as people are coming to Christ, one of the most difficult things for them is that now they're being identified as Jews rather than as Roman citizens, rather than as Greeks. And so they're experiencing cultural separation as well. It's a really difficult time for this church. And yet in the midst of it, they're reaching out, they're making a difference, they're being effective, and they're being faithful, even when they're being persecuted. And so despite being small, their reward is great. Faithfulness is not about what we do not have. Faithfulness is not about being the biggest or having the most numbers, nickels, and noses. It's about being faithful with what you have and using it to God's glory. As I was reading this story, I just couldn't help but think of the women in the correspondence course. In particular, the one woman who led so many people to Christ year after year after year. I got to know her a little bit. I didn't become good friends with her or anything like that. But I on occasion, I was sent on errands. One of the things we started doing eventually was that we would bring her correspondence stuff, and we would pick up her mail from the P.O. box for her. Different students were assigned that assignment so that we could take care of her and make sure that she was able to do that work unhindered, because she was physically less able to do that. I don't know when she might have passed from this life. After I left the school, I didn't hear any more stories about her. We didn't have email and all that cool stuff that we have today to keep up with all those correspondence. But I know that she didn't have any formal education. I know that she was crippled. I knew that she had very few resources, because I set foot in her house. It was a very small house with very few things. I knew that she didn't have much in the way of family, that her family was her correspondence family. I knew that she spent a lot of money on magazines and newspapers and a P.O. box and notebooks to keep track of her students. She didn't have a lot, but what she had, she used for God's glory. Last week, when we were going through this whole series, you know, I pointed to the parable of the coins. where the master gave each servant some gold coins according to their ability. To one he gave 10, to another he gave 5, and to one he gave a single coin. And when he returned, the one who had been faithful with the 10 coins received charge of 10 cities. Faithful with little, with 10 coins. Faithful with much, I'll give you governance over 10 cities when he came back. When he returned, the one who had been faithful with 5 coins, he said to him, faithful in little, faithful in much, and he gave him charge over 5 cities in his government. But to the one who had only 1 coin, who buried it, who was lazy and did nothing, that one he called lazy and wicked, and he threw him out into the darkness. The issue was never about what they had, but about using what they had been given to extend the kingdom of God. And I find it interesting that in chapter 3, we would have Sardis and Philadelphia right up next to each other like that. I have to believe that that's really intentional, that God put it together that way on purpose. You see, Sardis was a town of great reputation and supposed to be a place of power. Philadelphia, the church wasn't known for its power. It was known actually as being small and nothing significant. One had great reputation but did nothing. And Philadelphia had no reputation but was powerful for the sake of the kingdom. They were of no report, but they were found faithful with everything that God had given them. And you know, continually the thing that strikes me is that how each of us, being born here in the United States of America, wow, what tremendous opportunity we have. I mean, you and I have resources that most of the world only dreams about. I remember when I was a missionary in Mexico, and one of the things that we got into a discussion one time in a small group was because their impression was everybody in America is rich. Everybody. You know what I told them? It's true. It's true. Our minimum wage is significantly above the world poverty line by any stretch of the imagination. That many of those folks, by the vast majority in our church there, the wealthiest made $200 a week. Many of them survived just on coins, working in parking lots or in gas stations where they were not paid to pump gas. They were given the right to collect a tip. That's why in Mexico there's no self-serve stations. It's their way of taking care of their poor. They put in a green jumpsuit so they can pump gas for the government-owned Pemex stations. And then they get the change that people are able to give them after they're done pumping their fuel. Once their tank is full, or they put in what they can, they give them a few coins, many of them not worth a dime, literally. And that's how they make their living. But as we would talk about what it meant to be rich and everything, I said, well, you know, here's the thing, is that doesn't solve all your problems. You know, the thing is Americans have just as many problems as you have. They have family issues and they have difficult times and things like that. And the question is not about what Americans have. The question isn't about what you have here in Mexico. The question is what will you do with what you have? Will you be faithful? You see, when Americans are tithing and giving of their life and time and everything, they have to they do the same thing you do. They give 10% of what they have. And I guarantee you, if you have a house payment and all those other things, that it doesn't get any cheaper. That life is not suddenly somehow easier for them to do the tithe than anybody else, or that their time is every bit as important to them. Their families are every bit as important to them. It doesn't matter whether you're a rich American or a poor person in Mexico. It really doesn't matter. The question is what will you do with what you have? Well, you know that the church believed that. And so they eventually bought their own land and put together the money and the resources to build their own building. And they built their church building with what they had. It wasn't elaborate. It wasn't fancy. But they put a roof over our heads. With their little bit of money, we began to teach people how to cut hair. And they would go out and they would go out to the bad areas of Juarez, to the poor areas of Juarez. You got to think to yourself, if you're making $100 a week for a household, what are the poor areas doing? And so we would go out to the neighborhoods where Hondurans had fled from Honduras to get a better life in Juarez because you could make $100 a week. And if you really worked hard, you might make $200 a week working for the American companies. Yes, it gets that bad in the world. That you would run to Juarez, Mexico, where people are running to the United States to find a better life. People were running to Juarez, Mexico to find a better life, and they were there illegally. I bet you didn't know that could happen, did you? And they were running there, and they were coming, and the Mexican people didn't like them being there, taking their jobs. And we would go out to these little colonias, like Tierra Nueva, the new land, a place of hope, of no running water and no electricity, where the only electricity was when someone would take a power cord and they would strip it down and they'd put a hook on the end and they would throw it over the power lines and they would pirate power and they would tape those electrical cords together and they would run them through the ponds and through the holes and children would dance around and play in those ponds and oftentimes drop dead in those ponds because people were trying to have a little power, to have a little bit of a life, to have something better than what they had had before. And our church would go cut hair and pick out lice out of those children's heads from Honduras and Nicaragua and places like that, Guatemala. The people that they didn't like very much, who were stealing their jobs, who were making life much more difficult for people in Juarez. And they went and they cut their hair and they washed their heads. And every person who was learning to cut hair brought 5 burritos. 5 burritos. And as they cut somebody's hair, because that was all the time we had that morning, and each person who they cut their hair, they gave them a burrito so they would eat that day. They got a haircut, they got their head washed, and they got a burrito. And we built churches in Tierra Nueva. And we went up on the mountainside where it said, La Biblia es la verdad, léela. The Bible is the truth, read it. And they couldn't read it because they didn't speak Spanish. Did you know that 13 of the unreached people groups in the entire world live in northern Mexico? And when we go down there to Mexico as Americans and do mission work, we go to the Mexican people who have a church on every corner. But we don't go to the Mixteca people. We don't go to the Tarahumara people. We don't go to the Pima people. They're completely unreached. And they're on our doorstep. And they were living underneath that sign and couldn't read it. And there was a little government school the Mexicans had put together and they were teaching the Tarahumara children how to read. And so we would go up there and we would put our grill up and we would make pancakes. We would pull our cars up and we would turn our headlights on and hope our cars didn't. I had to jump start a lot of cars because, you know, most Mexican cars are really old. They're the cars that you wouldn't want to keep. They're the cars that were washed out in the flood and end up in Mexico. And we would turn on those headlights and we would gather in a circle and we would sing a song and we would teach a little Bible lesson to the children and their parents would sit around and then the children would stand up and they would share the gospel with their parents. But that wasn't Americans that were doing that. That was Mexicans. Mexicans who made less than $100 a week, most of them. Our haircutters. Our haircutters. We were training them to cut hair because they had no income. And so they would take the little bitty check that they would get from some government assistance and they would make those 5 burritos and they would bring them. They would come and they would help us make pancakes. I would buy the pancake batter and we would mix it up on the hill. And I knew it couldn't have been very good. other than the syrup. Because when we would drop a pancake, the ants didn't touch it. They don't touch hot dog buns either. Or hot dogs. At least not in Mexico, they don't. There's some discerning ants. But you see, they didn't do out of their abundance. They did with what they had. They were of little strength, of little power. But they made a humongous difference. They were reaching a people group that were completely untouched by the gospel, who lived under a sign that proclaimed to all the city of Juarez, to 3 million people, and to nearly 2 million people in the surrounding areas with El Paso and Santa Teresa and all the areas in New Mexico, that all could read that sign from all over the place. We could see in Spanish that the Bible was the truth and that you should read it. But those people living underneath had not a clue what it said until we told them and we began to share with them the good news of the gospel. And they made a difference. You know what was really interesting? Do you know that most people knew that they were up there? Because every Christmas, the busloads of from corporate America who worked in Juarez, and the factories in Juarez overseeing the Mexican workers who were making $100 an hour, making $200 an hour, many of them making $70,000, $80,000, $100,000 a year overseeing the Mexican workers, they would come in their busloads to the mountaintop. It was very difficult for them to get up there. And they would bring and the buses would line up, bus after bus after bus. And they would bring so much food and so much clothing that it would take us the entire rest of the year to process all that clothing of what happened, because people just took and took and took. And they would take their big turkeys that they had no place to cook, and because they didn't have an oven, they were just cooking it outside. And they would take all these groceries, and they had no refrigeration, and they had no ice to put it on or anything else. And so every January, the stench of our wealth that we had poured out filled the air with rot. And the little Mexican people, they just came back and they helped them clean up the mess and throw away all that unused food. And they brought their burritos. We made them pancakes. And they made a difference. They preached the gospel, and we established a church on that mountain, and we established a church among the Pima people who eventually, on their own conclusion, nobody said anything. We didn't say anything at all. They had fields and fields of marijuana. They were growing marijuana for the drugs to be sold in the United States of America. And the drug lords, the narcos, would come down and they would say, "If you don't keep these fields up, we will come back and we will kill the men of your village." And after we led them to Christ, and we taught daddies how to play soccer with their children because they wouldn't have anything to do with the children, and we began to make an impact in that community, we came back a year later, and those two villages of Pima people had been through a horrendous war with the narcos, where they had killed many of their men. Because sometime on their own, they were praying and they came to the conclusion that they weren't going to grow drugs to send to the United States anymore, that they didn't think that was a good thing to do, since these American Christians had taken time to come down there, since these Mexican Christians had come down there. They didn't want to pollute Mexico anymore. They didn't want to pollute the United States anymore with their marijuana. And so they made a decision on their own to stop growing it. And the drugs that supposedly don't hurt anybody here in the United States caused many people to lose their lives in the Pima village. But they rejoiced. They rejoiced when we came back and we were so devastated at what had happened. They said, "But many of our people have died at the hands of the narcos and went to hell." And now our people stood up for what was right. And we rejoice that they're in heaven. Can I just tell you that I will take 10 fired up old ladies over 10,000 self-centered people? Give me one sold out person making disciples over hundreds packed into pews with no intent to use their gifts to extend the mercy and the goodness of the kingdom of God to others. This is the call on our lives. Not to do amazing. Not for you to be the biggest and the best. Not for you to be the brightest. Not for you to be the most powerful. But for you to use the gifts that God has placed in your life. Whether it's teaching or it's hospitality or it's helping other people organize their lives, or whether it's serving people or opening your home and welcoming them in, whether it's cooking a meal, whatever your gifts are, whatever God has put into your life and given you the ability that you can serve each other and the larger world, and you can turn the world upside down. I mean, in Acts chapter 17, when they come to Ephesus and they say, these people who have gone all over the world have come here also. They've turned the whole world upside down, and now they're going to turn upside down Ephesus. They were a people of little means, of little power. They had nothing but shoe leather express, no fax machines, no airplanes, no power boats, no nothing. They didn't have a printing press. And they turned the world upside down in 17 years by Shoe Leather Express. They went all over the Roman Empire. They started with 12. Ordinary fishermen sold out to Jesus. They gathered hundreds. And on the day of Pentecost, hundreds turned into thousands because they used what they had. They opened up their hearts and they said, God, use us. If you have one gift or 10, if you have $1 or $10 billion, if you have one friend or 10,000 friends, use what we have for the glory of God, to make disciples of Jesus Christ, to extend the hope, the healing, the ministry of the kingdom. A few weeks ago, I sent out a newsletter and I said, you know, look, we're boiling it down to just five things that we want to see people do. Serve people, give back to God, extend the kingdom of God, build our community through life groups, and live a godly lifestyle. Man, every one of those things is filled with so much. But that call to action isn't about really coming to an altar. You know, on a regular basis, almost every Sunday, we have an altar call. We ask people to come up here and to pray with people, to surrender their lives to Christ, to come get prayer for anything else they need. And I don't want to take that away from anybody today. We're going to still ask our prayer team people to come up if you need some ministry. But here's my call to action. Here's the altar I want you to go to. It's called the world. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son. And so that's the altar I'm asking us to go pour ourselves out on. That we would go to our neighbors and our friends and our families and our coworkers and our classmates and our clubs and our teams and the people that we've met here at church and any place that you have influence, whatever influence that you have, whatever resources you have, however great or small, and that you would take time to pour those into them and make disciples of Jesus Christ. So let's go. Let's go. Let's stand together. And I ask the prayer teams, go ahead and come on up here. And We're going to have prayer teams up in the front and in the back. If you need some prayer this morning, I'm not telling you not to get prayer. That certainly wouldn't be my goal. But my real hope today is for you and I to get out of here and go be the church. This isn't church. This building, this isn't church. This is a church building. It's a house of worship. But it's not the church. You are the church. And when you go out and you are the hands and feet of Jesus, I don't care whether it's loving a family member, whether it's showing your love and kindness to one another. I think one of the significant traits of the early church was it said that they had all things in common and no one was lacking. Gosh, I would love to see that in the church today. Or maybe it's your neighbor or whomever. Maybe it's your enemy. Boy, you know they need Jesus, right? Right? It's okay, you can laugh. But for you and I, the real call is that we would love God, that we would love people, and that we'd pass it on. Let's go to the world, shall we? Let's be people of little power, but great faithfulness. God bless.